Flashback Twin Cities. Tom Osmond here for the next hour, well, second hour of a two-hour marathon of Tom Osmond and Stan Turner here.
Kind of an amalgamated show today.
I think two more hours after, let's just till 4 o'clock.
Good stuff. We might go to 4 or 5. There's no stopping us now, Tom.
Not at all. I apologize if you were tuning in to hear Marsha Floor today. She cannot speak. Not that she doesn't want to, but she had some laryngitis. We're going to have Marsha on in October, but the best thing beyond Marsha Floor is Stan Turner in for a second segment here. Welcome back, Stan.
It's good to see you again, Tom. It's been a long time, about 3.5 minutes. And you've grown taller since I saw you last.
I've grown something, not necessarily taller, okay, but you were my first guest on the first Flashback Twin Cities back in November, and you're making your, you're kind of the Joey Bishop here of the Flashback Twin Cities.
I call it an encore by demand.
Thank you.
Command performance,
But we're just going to kind of continue what we were doing the last hour. If you listened, we had some clips, and I wanted to talk a little bit about today. Well, first of all, we're going to have a guest later in the day, Peter Thiel. He was Barbara Carlson's producer. He liked our show last week and wanted to...
it was a good show, by the way. Very good.
Yeah. It was a fun show. It was, as I expected, a few twists and turns, but we had a great time and got a lot of good feedback on that. Barbara, a very honest person. She's not one to hold back her opinions and her thoughts on anything, anyone, but it was good. It's good radio. And her producer, Peter Thiel, who was a 20-some-year-old producer when he met Barbara, and I think there might be some good stories.
I bet his hair was gray by the time he finished with her.
Well, you know, there might be some good stories behind that. In fact, we were reaching out an email, and he says, ask me about this, this, and this, and I said, I will. But let's. I want to talk about. We played last hour some clips from All News Channel, which I incorrectly called a station. It was a network. I think that now, Stan, correct me if I'm wrong. Did you ever go to the grocery store and someone said, "Hey, I saw you on TV at 3 a.m. What was that all about?"
It was all about this. You would get that. They'd say, "Gee, you work all night long," and I said, "No, I don't. Actually, I leave about 11 o'clock." What you saw, dear viewer, was a videotape of the 10 o'clock newscast I did the previous night. So just a couple hours before they saw it. So what would we do? We would rerun the late newscast unless the content went outdated, in which case there was another crew there on duty who would update the newscast, do it live. That tape would then roll through the rest of the early morning hours. What really got me, though, is the comments. We had a lot of comments. A lot of people saw it. Said, I didn't know you moved to Dallas. We just got back from Barbados.
Right.
We just got back from Montreal, and you were on the television, and I didn't know you moved to Canada. Well, no, that was the satellite. We were all over the place. We were in that small little studio behind Channel 5 studios. It was part of the Hubbard Empire there.
So you were still...
So we had our own... Yeah, we had our own physical setup there. But to think, sitting in a room about this size, which is quite small, you know, with the control room too, not very big, and to think you were just getting all over the North American continent into the Caribbean and all the rest. It was amazing the reach we had.
And let's talk about that. So you were at the time you were anchoring for Channel 5, and you had the opportunity to do this. Did Hubbard say, hey, we have this new...
He was very excited about it. Satellite news. CNN had already shown the way, but he found a way. Very bright guy, very creative, and he had a plan there, and it looked pretty good on paper, and I thought it looked pretty good on the air, too. He put it together, and a lot of people pitched in and helped him. So he cherry-picked some of us out of Channel 5 and hired others, and we had a big crew over there. CONUS, it was called, Continental United States. That was the technical side of it. We were all news channels, so we were the on-air side of it. And bringing in reports from all over the country, and then we'd repackage them and put them out on the network. So say, for example, you were our affiliate station in Miami Beach. You had a story that happened down, a news story that was of national interest. You'd feed it to our headquarters up here, right, by satellite. We'd turn it around and put it within our newscast and put it out there nationwide.
And the brilliant thing about Hubbard in this particular juncture was he had created DirecTV. So if you have these little satellite dishes around town, that was really Hubbard's
DirecTV was a competitor, and the one that ultimately ate him. He was called USSB.
Oh, I'm sorry. You are correct.
United States Satellite Broadcasting. I never liked the title. I kind of almost told him that. I thought DirecTV, his competitor, that was a much better title because it kind of does what it says, DirecTV. It was direct, you know, from the source to you via the satellite dish.
But the only news channel on USSB was... All News Channel.
That's right.
And
that's
you'd go to Best Buy, or at the time it was probably Circuit City or Audio King. You'd see this dish there, and it was actually pretty interesting. You'd try to change channels, and there's All News Channel right there. There's Stan Turner right there at Best Buy.
Isn't that a shame? Anyway, there we were. Yeah.
So you did this, and I just want to play a little. Here's a clip from 1996. This is All News Channel on a typical day.
Reaction to the verdict in the Bernard Goetz civil trial.
I think I'll just start the bidding at $5,000. We have $5,000.
And here's bidding at Sotheby's to own a piece of history. Hello, everyone. I'm Stan Turner. We'll get to those stories in just a moment. But first, a month-old baby is on life support after being beaten by three young boys. Police in California say the boys...
Well, let's not depress the viewers, the audience just yet, shall we?
Well, again, you have to remember, it was hard for us to conceive of this, but we were talking to millions of people in that little studio there, thanks to the satellite. Got us all over. I'm not kidding when I said Barbados. Mm-hmm. And places like that, the Virgin Islands, all over the place, Mexico. Well, and it was just the reach, the impact. And again, I'm not saying we were anywhere near the audience that CNN was reaching. They were reaching a worldwide audience, mm-hmm. of course, but we were out there. So it was really exciting.
Well, also, the Showtime Cable Network had it for a while as an affiliate, and also... There's airports that used to have All News Channel on the airport. I remember being at the airport one time, and I mean, you're saying you're with me all the time.
We were watching you, Tom. You need watching.
That's correct. But there was All News Channel, Stan Turner there. And then it would air 3 hours. People used to...
Making your trip more enjoyable, Tom.
It was enjoyable, but... Before I was the media scholar I am today, I wondered, why is Stan Turner doing 6 hours of news a night? But that's... It was
a lot of people were asking that, Tom.
A half hour repeated many times, and occasionally I'd change. Dave Dahl would be doing the weather occasionally on there.
Yes, he would. I'm happy to say I was proud of the effort we put forward. We didn't have anywhere near the resources of a CNN, but considering what we had to work with, I think it was a pretty good product.
Exactly. And unfortunately, the time to sell was apparently right for the Hubbard family, and they sold the whole operation. Yeah. And
that stunned me, because the Hubbards rarely sell. They hold on to things, and they nurture them and bring them along. Mm-hmm. And I can understand the business decision here, you know, but I was shocked at first. Mm-hmm. My goodness, he never does this, but he did this time. And there was a lot of money. There were millions of dollars at stake here that flowed into his pocket from this, so you can't blame him for doing it.
No, and... So September 30th, 2002 was the last day of All News Channel. Right, and I actually have the clip of the last day of All News Channel.
I remember the day.
That is our report for this half hour. This is All News Channel's final newscast. We've been here for almost 13 years now. It was our goal to bring you accurate, clear, and meaningful stories, reporting that made a difference to you. Since we announced we were going away, many of you have written and called to tell us that you will miss ANC, and we thank you so much for that. As you know, it takes many people working together to bring you this kind of programming, and tonight, I hope you will take time to read the names of all those who helped bring this to you. I'm Stan Turner. Across America in 30 minutes, this was All News Channel.
I was on the edge of breaking up, because so many good people had worked so hard for so long, and it's just hard to end something like that. It fell to me to have to do the farewell. And I remember we had a gathering downtown Minneapolis at the Times restaurant, and they had big monitors up there, and we saw it on the rerun, and I had to leave the room. I couldn't watch it. It hurt too much.
Well, and All News Channel was not a flashy operation. No.
Its credit, it was not flashy.
No, exactly. It was not, I'm not using the term sexy as, right. And you know the term, a journalist term.
Exactly, yes.
It was a product, and it was what was needed, and it was actually a good, they aired at daytime and nighttime, and actually smaller affiliates, right. It was fantastic for them to have a national news product.
It was. So, bottom line, I think all of us who were involved with it are very proud, and hats off to Stanley Hubbard for creating it and financing it, and we understand why he had to end it, but it was still painful.
And I'm sure you still, once in a while, still get, are you still doing that late-night news?
Oh, sure. I still get lots of comments about it. You stayed up all night long. No, I did not.
Now, one more thing I want to talk about before you go for ending your radio marathon today.
Right.
We were talking about... political reporting and gridlock in politics, and you did the Capitol beat for a long time.
I did.
And let me ask you a question. Talk to me a little bit about gathering news in the Capitol in the 70s when you did it.
Well, here's what I did. I went from home, not to the station, but right to the state Capitol building or wherever what was going to be happening that day was happening, be it the state office building or if the governor was coming into Holman Field after flying around the state, we'd be there. So I never went to the station first. I went down there and we reporters at the source told the news desk back at the station what was happening. I understand that's getting reversed somewhat these days.
Right.
Telling the reporter, we'll tell you what you're going to find. Well, it doesn't work that way. A reporter is at the field. It works a beat, as we call it. The eyes and the ears of the news station is right there. So I would go down, and every day, probably the day before, I'd have a pretty good idea what was going to happen the next day, tell the news desk what was going to go, and have a camera crew ready to go, and we'd do it. Sometimes things would change when I got there in the morning, and we'd just adjust to that. So and this was just where we could bring the satellite truck down and feed the tape back from the state capitol. I remember when we used to have to send the film back by cab to the station from the state capitol, get it into the chemicals, develop it, then run back and, you know, supervise the editing of it. You know, literally glued the film together.
Let me ask you about that.
This sounds like 1920,
doesn't it? No, because this was not, a product that is so outside of our memories here.
Yeah.
I remember taking film to, you know, Blacks or Target, whatever it is, and you have to get it back in a few days. How did you guys put out film hours after you shoot it?
I mean, because we had our own laboratory on the premises there. We had full-time lab technicians whose job it was solely to process the film, taking care of the chemicals, making sure they have the correct heat, and we'd rush the film back from location, hand it over to the lab guys. They'd put it in the soup, as we call it, the chemicals. It would come out of the dryer about 20, 30 minutes later, over to the editing booth, and we'd sit down with an editor there and go through it and start cutting it. It's about 12 minutes to air time. It's frantic. We're trying to get this thing together, and oh, wow. I'll tell you what, you could get really a really serious case of stomach knots, and we did too, but there was adventure and excitement to it too.
And don't you long maybe to go back to now and take your video camera and your phone now and be able to just do your report there from the Capitol and send it over?
It'd be great. It was nice being able to do what we call live shots right from the Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
So major stories, you could run out on the front lawn of the Capitol. We used to rub a little hole in the lawn there from standing there so often doing stand-ups. You know, you see the Capitol dome in the background, same place. So we'd kill the grass where we stood every day.
I always figured there's actually a place marker. Okay, Channel 5 stands here and Channel 4 stands here.
Just about.
And it's actually so scenic, the Capitol with the lights on. You imagine all these lawmakers down to the books, not drinking or smoking.
No, they weren't. They were looking at TV monitors in their offices to see if they were going to be in our reports. That's what they were doing.
Right.
Sure.
And this is the day before the lobbying laws took effect. So there was probably a little bit of maybe some alcohol, some smoking, some backroom deals.
I heard tell of it, but I'd never tell the tale. It wouldn't be fair.
We'd have to channel Irv Johnson to ask about that.
Yeah, maybe.
Mm-hmm. And I'm also picturing that I remember when 1500 gave up their Capitol radio office. They'd had since the 30s, I think, at the Capitol. And I'm picturing these small little booths they had at the Capitol that they were reporting from. Those had to have some history in those.
Well, when I went on the beat at the state Capitol, the Capitol Press Corps, had our quarters up off the rotunda on the second level. It was the best place in the entire Capitol because there were French doors opening onto the front veranda. So we could sit out there, do interviews, look across the beautiful green lawn, and maybe even put our feet up once in a while, waiting for that next story to come along. And, of course, the lobbyists were always trying to take us out to lunch, and the elevator was right next door.
Mm-hmm.
So the lobbyists would come and say, "You guys hungry?" "Yeah, we are, so take us down to the restaurant." They eventually moved the press corps to the basement, where we belonged, right? And I'm the guy who picked out the Channel 5 News room there, that little small room. They still use it today. They probably hate me because it's one of the smaller rooms. I don't know. It's before we had all our video editing gear in there, so it was just fine for our purposes.
Pencil and a pen?
Not quite that primitive, Tom. I mean, we had cameras and stuff.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, come on.
And by the way, the film that you mentioned before, the Hubbard family did donate thousands of rolls of films to the Minnesota Historical Society.
Do.
I hope they find the resources down the road to be able to digitize that
for
the future. I worked on that for a while, and
that was a great gift from the Hubbards to the people of Minnesota. Really,
it's all
history.
And I encourage people to tell the History Center they want to see that film because I worked on it for about 3 years, and there's so much film there that it's going to take a lot of people to be able to.
And thanks to you for helping on that too, Tom. It's very important work.
Very very little help, unfortunately, because there's just so much history there. But there is film from the 40s to the 80s, it's a great archive. And thank you for having local ownership in this town to be able to have that for us.
Right,
Stan. Thanks for sticking
around
for our second segment today.
And thank you for being on my really big shoe today. It was fun.
Let's take a break. We'll be back on Flashback Twin Cities after this. Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osman here again for another segment here. In 1986, one of the most popular TV shows on TV was Dallas. And Dallas had went through a ratings challenge, and this is why. Patrick Duffy, tired of playing the role of, and if you don't remember Dallas was the show of a wealthy oil tycoon family in Dallas, Texas, who had a lot of problems that your middle-class families do, except they had more money to be able to throw around. But Patrick Duffy, who played J.R. Ewing, Larry Hagman's brother Bobby, decided he was tired of the weekly grind of playing the foil to J.R. Ewing and left the show in 1985. Flash forward 1 year later, and Dallas's ratings were dismal, and they needed to bring the character back. Unfortunately, as happens in TV quite often, the character gets killed off and was buried in a very elaborate funeral. The whole storyline, in fact, of that year was played around Patrick Duffy's character, Bobby, dying. So when Patrick Duffy decided to come back to the show, what do you do? How do you bring a character back to the show that had been died and buried? Well, in the season finale of Dallas, Bobby Ewing appeared in his former wife's shower, and he says, hello. So all summer, the viewers are left wondering, how is Bobby Ewing back alive? Let's listen to some audio. This is the season premiere of Dallas from 1986. A listener named David Olson alerted me this was 27 years ago this week, so I want to make sure we talk about this slightly.
Documentaries. See what's to see at KBC.
WCCO Television, Minneapolis, St. Paul.
The best way to bring this character back is to have him in the shower saying good morning. The story of how Bobby came back was so secret that Patrick Duffy and, in fact, the cast was not told of how he's going to come back. Patrick Duffy was told they were filming a soap commercial, Irish Spring. So the crew, the production crew, thinks that they're just taping a soap commercial. They don't know that Patrick Duffy's going to be coming back in the shower. Flash forward 1 year later, here he comes back. And now we have to figure out how is he back? Is this a evil twin brother? Is this an imposter? Or was the whole year a dream? Well, yes, the whole year was a dream. What many people find was Dallas's jump the shark moment. Jump the shark meaning that the show was kind of lost all sense of reality, was when the whole year was just a dream. That Patrick Duffy actually hadn't died at all, and the whole season of Dallas between 85 and 86 was just a dream of his former wife, Pamela, played by Victoria Principal. I know many people that have watched Dallas and found that was the moment in time when they stopped watching, because if you're going to watch a show for a year and then the show becomes a farce or becomes a whole dream, then what's the point of getting invested in a show? Let's listen slightly now. There's some commercials that aired that night. Let's just pump that audio back up, Kyle.
Dallas, sponsored by Bayer Aspirin. Bayer, the wonder drug that works wonders. Dallas will continue.
Here it comes.
On tonight's 10 p.m. report, we're going to take you to a workout studio that does the exercising for you. It doesn't promise weight loss, but you should develop firmer muscles. Do you need to buy new license plates? We'll have the latest in the Minnesota license plate saga. And we're going to go live to a Dallas party celebrating the return of Bobby Ewing. Or is it a lookalike? Or was it all a bad dream? Those stories and more tonight at 10 on Channel 4.
Kyle, have you any idea what I'm talking about? This is totally new to you, this show?
I've heard of the show. I don't think I ever watched it.
Well, there might be some people here at KLEB who've watched it, but that was how do you take a character that dies and how do you bring him back? Well, the only way to do it was to make the whole last year a dream. Kyle, why don't we get our guests on the line? Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back with Peter Thiel. He was Barbara Carlson's producer. I want to talk to him a little bit about producing for Barbara Carlson and what he's been up to. We'll take a quick break and come back on Flashback Twin Cities here on KLBB. Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osmond here for another half hour of the day, another murky Saturday afternoon. If you enjoyed that Dallas audio, it is on YouTube, actually, under the old TC Media Now YouTube site. You just type in Dallas season premiere, WCCO. You can hear Don Shelby promote the Dallas party that was going on that night and also see the infamous Bobby Ewing popping out of the shower scene. And also thanks to Stan Turner for sticking around for a half hour. Stan and I both had guests that had other challenges today, so we were doing a radio marathon today. We had a guest last week, and this is a guest I'd wanted to be on the show for a long time, Barbara Carlson. Barbara Carlson, who, again, is a very very honest, matter-of-fact woman, a very memorable moment in broadcasting here at the Twin Cities at 1500. And the only unfortunate part about our next guest is we didn't have him on last week. This actually would have been really good radio. Not sure how two phone calls would have worked out, because our next guest, Peter Thiel, I believe is in New York. Are you, Peter?
No, I am now in San Antonio, Texas.
Okay. How long have you been there?
About 4 months, 5 months.
Okay. And what are you doing out there?
I am consulting.
Okay.
And about, I'll tell you just the quick and the short of it. My wife and I had decided at the end of 2012, early 2013, that we were going to make a little bit of a life change. And that life change would be to get out of living by walking like ants into underground travel things and living through terror zone type things. So we decided that we were going to leave at the end. But because of Hurricane Sandy and because of commitments I made to some friends, there was an event. I was working for Salem Communications in New York, and we had to cancel a big event at Yankee Stadium, and we had rescheduled it for April. I decided to stay through that event coming off. So right after that event being rescheduled in April, I put in a one-month notice the day after that event came off. And then we came down to San Jose, or San Antonio.
And there's some great weather in San Antonio.
It's beautiful. It's a great city.
And, Peter, are you originally from Minnesota?
Yeah, I'm originally from Minnetonka.
And
I'm a Tonka boy.
That's great. And you had the fortune of being a 20-some-year-old producer on what was then known as Barbara Carlson and Friends. I want you to tell me a little bit about how that all came about.
Well, Barbara was brought in after Kloby didn't really work, Jim Klobuchar.
Right.
And so Barbara came in, and they had an original producer who cried every day.
Well,
and so they brought me in, and Barbara looked at me, and she said, "Are you tough?" And I looked at her, and I said, "Tougher than you."
Wow.
And so she asked for me to be fired at least once a week for our entire 5 years together.
Did you take these firing threats serious at a certain point? I know when I was when I was that age, I probably would have taken it pretty seriously. You wouldn't with this very dominant personality. She's calling the shots. I mean, and maybe she wasn't calling the shots. I'm not sure how the directorship went there.
Early in the game, I did. I was a little scared, but then I realized that no one wanted to work with her, and that as the show was beginning to develop and beginning to work, that they really needed me, and I was really important for the show.
Mm-hmm.
And the chemistry of the show really worked.
And had you worked for 1500 prior to being on Barbara's show?
Yes, I was there for about 3 years before.
Who did you work for prior to that?
Oh, I had done every shift in the building.
Mm-hmm.
I had, I was actually, before the rookie, I had run more of Monday night and Saturday morning sports talk than anybody.
Right. So this had to
be I had worked with Bruce Gordon. I had worked with the former news director, John McDougal. McDougal and I were very close friends. We had a very tough start together, but McDougal and I became very close and became very close with a lot of the staffers. Got to know Bob Yates, got to know a lot of the hosts of that era. I was not someone who kissed up to people.
Mm-hmm.
And there were different people that came in and out of that era on the producing side that were kiss-ups, and I was not a kiss-up. I was somebody that did what I had to do, and I believed in the station, I believed in the format, and I believed in the Hubbard family. I love the Hubbards, love them to this day. I think they do tremendous things for broadcasting. I think they're tremendous for the Twin Cities and for Minnesota. I have tremendous respect for everybody.
Well, let's just talk a little bit of history here. The AM market of radio in the late 80s was pretty dormant. It was not, I mean, music had all but escaped AM radio. And talk radio before the Parents Doctrine had been, and the Parents Doctrine was everything had to be equal. If you have a left point of view, you have to have a right point of view. So
yeah.
Most stations didn't have anything of opinion, or for that matter, personality on radio. So at that point, when Rush Limbaugh had evolved, and if you like him or don't like him, that's anyone's, to their judgment. But Rush Limbaugh did change AM radio.
Well, I have a funny story about that.
Please go. Tell me.
I have a funny story about that. I was going to college in Sacramento and was an early talk radio fan and was a big listener to Morton Downey Jr. And Rush Limbaugh took Morton Downey Jr.'s slot in Sacramento.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard Rush's first day as a local host.
Wow.
And when Jeff Charles quit to go to Miami, I said to the program director at the time, Mike Dorwart, who's now in Jacksonville, Florida, has been there since leaving KSTP, I said, you really should look at Rush Limbaugh. And Dorwart looked at me and he said, Peter, you're like an intern part-timer. I don't know if you really know what you're talking about.
Right.
Why don't you call this guy and have him send a demo tape to me? Sacramento isn't even really that big of a market. I don't even know if he'd be able to compete here.
Well,
within a year, Limbaugh was at WABC New York, and his syndicated show was rolling out within months.
And KSP being one of the first affiliates to actually have Rush Limbaugh, which was for them
correct.
A very, very profitable venture for a long time.
And that's a totally true story.
No, it's interesting because that is really kind of the birth of what 1500 was when you were there. It was they had tried to do CCO's model of being all things to all people, which doesn't always work because you're trying to spread yourself too thin.
It never worked.
And then they tried a little bit, and you mentioned Jim Klobuchar, who was a fantastic columnist, but maybe radio wasn't what worked for him. I know Lee Balswick was there for a while. Bruce Gordon, as you mentioned.
Great lady, and still a very good friend of mine. I exchange notes with her every once in a while, and one of the great people in the world, Lee Balswick.
Our guest today, Peter Thiel, talking about his days at 1500. So about 1990-91, Barbara Carlson, who was a former city councilwoman and our guest last week, and we talked about her with us a little bit. Barbara didn't want to talk about the past. She wanted to talk about the future, but I was trying to, being this flat-back Twin Cities, want to talk about the past. You might remember better than anyone bringing Barbara in from being what was one of the few conservatives on the Minneapolis City Council, and a conservative on the Minneapolis City Council is not very conservative, but that is what she was. And then also very outspoken, very, I'm not trying to use the word outrageous too often, but very different. And then her bringing that we'll call it act, or bringing that persona to radio. You were there. And how did that go?
Yeah, it was a conversion. It didn't take a long. You know, she wanted guests. All she wanted to do was interview people for an hour at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to break her of that. I said, you're highlighting guests. I want to highlight you.
Mm-hmm.
And so slowly but surely that began to change. When I came in, all she was playing is big band music. I said, you know, we're not doing that anymore. I'm playing the music. It's punk. I played punk rock. I played, you know, some heavy metal. I was not a big heavy metal fan. Primarily alternative and punk rock. It was music of the time. And she goes, I hate that. And I said, it's not about you, it's about the audience. And I said, your attitude's punk rock. I said, you rock the city council, you're going to rock radio. And realizing this, she was in the market number two and number three sometimes, men 25-54.
Mm-hmm.
She was killing it.
And it's amazing that for you know, a woman at her age at the time, and being the male demographics usually were morning radio, sports radio, Tom Bernard, that was their audience. But she found a market in men that worked. And I think that the novelty at the time of having someone of her age and her look and her what she'd say, it was different and new and not heard before.
Yeah, and it was breaking lots of stereotypes. She was outrageous, but you know, she was being herself. A lot of times she would say stuff about the governor, but what was really funny is that she was very protective of him. The dynamics between her and Arnie, I heard the interview, I heard the replay. She and Arnie, their dynamics, even though they've been divorced for a whole lot of time, and Arnie's wife, Susan, is really a great person. I think the world of her, and mm-hmm. I like the governor a lot. And I like their kids a whole lot. I think Annie and Tucker are two of the great people. Barbara's very protective of Arnie, very protective. And if anyone was going to take a shot at Arnie, it was more than likely me on the air.
Right, for not being...
I took cheap shots.
Enough.
I made fun of him.
No, and it's...
And
no, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I ended up being having fun with it, and I did gubernatorial moments. I did all sorts of stuff, made all sorts of fun of Arnie, and not in a bad way, just in a playful way. He had to make fun of the thing. She was very protective of him, and that, it wasn't just for the kids' sake. It was for she really had a deep-seated respect for him. And a great deal of affection for him.
And you were there for the one-on-one interviews where Barbara had Arnie in the room. That's what I would find interesting.
Oh, yeah.
I've read the book, and I've also read stories between the two of them, which some of them are sound a little outrageous. Some of them sound a little bit the dynamic was a little bit rough. But you were there when they both of them were in the room together, and what was that like?
Imagine how uncomfortable it would be for both of them. Arnie being the governor and your ex-wife has a radio show. Come on. And somebody who, Barbara doesn't have a filter.
So the Barbara that we hear and see, that's the Barbara. It's not an act. That's the real Barbara.
Yeah, no. It's, I got a call from somebody. You know, Barbara got her got the station call letters with a mouth with a zipper wide open on her butt. And she's at some nice restaurant for lunch somewhere over, I forget the name of the restaurant, it's probably not even there anymore, but over in Uptown. And a buddy of mine that I grew up with out in Tonka is having a business lunch. And Barbara is dropping trow, showing her tattoo on her butt in the middle of lunch.
There's a couple of different reported incidents of that.
Yeah, and she did this all the time, by the way. It was very common. And and I get this call saying, Peter, can you tell her to keep her pants up? I really don't want to see her posterior during a business meeting at lunch. I said, I can't do that. I could tell her, but it's just, I can't, it's tough for me to keep her under control for, 2.5 hours on the radio.
There's a job for you. How many years were you her producer?
5 years.
That is a long time actually to be a producer for anyone's show, much less, it had been an education just on how to, was your next job after that one, was that easy compared to what you did?
No, I ended up doing morning drive and programming two radio stations.
Mm-hmm.
I took about a year away. I took about a year away, where I did a little bit of sales, and I had to take a little time to decompress. Did a little bit of sales, and I created a TV show for Channel 11 with Joe Garbarino,
mm-hmm.
called Cafe Care.
Okay.
And it was funny. I produced the absolute first episode of the show. That I took over a year to create with Joe. We got the green light. I produced, wrote, and directed it. Roxanne Battle was the host of the show. It got it on the air, and I believe Sam Silverman took it over from KFan, took it over as the weekly producer.
Mm-hmm.
And the show was a tremendous success. And it ran till the FCC changed the rules about how much children's programming could be run on TV, on local TV stations. It was a Saturday morning show. And it got on the air. It did very well in ratings. And it ended up going from there. But I never saw an episode of it. I don't even have one tape of it. I ended up having to go down to Huntsville, Alabama, where I got my first programming. I programmed a news talk and a sports talk at the station that and for the same owner that gave Sean Hannity his first job.
Wow. Well, there might, might be a tape of that somewhere. I might be able to find it, Peter. I have a tendency to find these tapes
at the
strangest places.
That would be fantastic. I got the opportunity of creating that, and I was thrilled that Channel 11 and Garbarino gave me that opportunity, because that's a once-in-a-lifetime deal.
So in all honesty, producing for Barbara actually ended up being more fun and interesting than some of the consecutive jobs you had thereafter.
Well, I've had great opportunities, and I'm having great opportunities now. I'm doing radio consulting, and I have an ad agency where I'm working with long-form radio programmers, and I'm able to do a lot of neat things. I don't regret, I'm sort of like Barbara in that way. I get to do exciting stuff. I actually have a small record label where we just put out a jazz album. And so I've gotten to do all sorts of things. So I ended up going to Huntsville, Alabama, Greenville, South Carolina, where I was programming a stage news talk station, San Francisco, California, and then I got to go to New York and put a news talk station on the air, flip a station and news talk in New York. That was my career dream, by the way. When I was going to Brown Institute,
mm-hmm.
and I was in class, and by no means was I the smartest kid, most talented kid, anything going on when I was at Brown, or in any class I was ever in, but I was in Brown, I always said, I'm going to New York, Chicago, or L.A. I just kept repeating that in class to the point where I think that everybody just sat there and said, you're really obnoxious. You're an obnoxious jerk. You're a moron. And I said, nope, I'm going. And I think they just laughed at me.
Mm-hmm. Does that give you the?
And I ended up.
Go ahead, sorry.
I got to go to New York. I got to program for almost 6 years.
The best
motivation
is someone telling you you can't do it. That's what I always found. If you tell me you can't do it, it makes me want to do it all the more, and I'm going to prove you wrong.
Well, it was my goal. It was in my head. I was going to do it. And I think that's what should be in anybody's head for whatever they're going to do. Whatever you're going to do, whatever you want to be, set your goal, make it high, and do it. Because you can do whatever you want. There is nothing holding you back. The only thing holding you back, of course, is you.
Right, I think you'd probably agree, Peter, that if you want something bad enough, then go and do it. Talking about it or thinking about it's not going to make it happen. It's going to be doing it, and it's going to be making a roadmap on how to do it. I think it's great. I think that we always love to see people from Minnesota, if they're going to leave Minnesota, leave part of our families here we have, or leave our airwaves, go on to greater and bigger things. And the best part now about social media is that we can actually keep in touch with, and we contact it through Facebook. And do you still get some emails occasionally from 1,500 listeners saying, hey, weren't you the guy That's great.
All the time. It's humbling. It's very humbling. I'll get notes on Twitter. I'll get notes on LinkedIn. I'll get notes on Facebook. All the time from people, and I'm going, this is now turning into a long time ago. Mm-hmm. I haven't been on the radio in the Twin Cities for 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's humbling, it's nice, and I've always appreciated it because it's, it was a terrific part of my career. And I thank everybody. I thank the folks for enjoying what I did. And I was always hoping that we were doing good work, that we were providing what we thought we were doing for the folks.
Mm-hmm. Every good radio host needs
Barbara,
a good producer.
Barbara worked very hard. I worked very hard every day.
Well, I appreciate you coming on the show today. I do have to ask you before we take off here. You had a good Mike Lynn, Tom Bernard story that I think that I want to hear.
Yeah, it's this is probably, you're probably gonna, in the internet thing, you'll probably say I'm a troll after you hear this, but I'll tell the story anyways. I'm a big Dan Culhane fan, and Dan Culhane had just gotten whacked on the morning show over there, and it was well before the Barbara Carlson era. Mm-hmm. And I was, I think, working overnight, and I may have been still part time at KSTP, so I was driving home, working overnight, and all of a sudden, there's the remarkable Mike Lynn on with Tom Bernard. So I quickly get home and pick up the phone, and I call in, and I'm sitting on hold for about a half hour to get on the air with Mike Lynn and Tom Bernard. And I'm just sort of waiting it out to get on. And so Mike Lynn, former general manager of the Vikings, and obviously a great guy. I sit there and I, of course, greet Mike Lynn's suit. Hello, Mike Lynn. Nice meeting you, and of course, nice speaking with your suit. And of course, famous for like $2,000 suits, and everybody's laughing, everybody's happy, and I asked some innocuous Vikings question. They're keeping me on the air, which was, not a good idea. Hmm. And I unfortunately made a comment, and I want to apologize publicly. I called Tom Bernard a big fat jerk.
Oh, boy. That's...
And so I'm confessing right now. Never told the story anywhere else. I want to apologize, but I was competitive, and I was probably about 23 at the time. So I apologize. I've never told it anywhere else. You've got the scoop.
I appreciate that. This is great. I do think that hindsight after a decade or after when you're in your 30s, you wouldn't do what you did in your 20s. But hey, commendable to you for apologizing. I also appreciate you giving the scoop to Flashback Twin Cities here, because that's a good story. Speaking of that, radio, you say radio trolls, but you must remember back in, what you're doing now, or even back when you were at 1500, the same callers have call in week after week, day after day, with extreme, intense, important opinions that they wanted to get out there. You must remember those names.
Yeah, we, as a general rule, I fought against that, and I would make, if there was a caller that was called named Steve from Columbia Heights, I believe, mm-hmm. and I made him call in only once a month,
mm-hmm.
and I eventually banned. There was a caller from, there was Babbling Ed, Guy the hockey player. Guy, I think, passed away. His family called while I was still there. Babbling Ed was great because you could put him on the air and he would just sort of ramble on. He would never be offensive and you could go use the restroom. There were certain, and then there were good regular callers that weren't overly, distinctive. They always asked a real good perceptive question.
That'll happen once in a while. It was kind of
I didn't like callers who were too regular. And as a program director, I fought against that. I really disliked, really recognizable callers.
Yeah, it's kind of the early day commentators. Now people can go on the internet, onto a blog or the web, StarTribune.com, and they can express their ever important opinions daily on there. But in this era, it was still either a letter to the editor, which rarely got printed, or talk radio. And this is really kind of what I think is called the golden age of talk radio. Late 80s, 90s. This is when a lot of markets around the country figure out a way to make lots of profit off of talk radio. And I think that it's, you were a big part of that. And it's great to have your perspective on that era with a lot of great hosts. You mentioned Bob Yates, Barbara Carlson, even your
Jesse Ventura, Trey Ryder.
Jesse Ventura, Trey Ryder. It's
John
amazing.
Vogel.
Amazing to think that Jesse Ventura, Trey Ryder, Barbara Carlson were all the same station on, and Limbaugh on the same station on a given day for a long time.
Oh, it was great. Ventura, his producer, Dave Ruth, I talked to on a real regular basis. He lives about 2 hours away from me.
Okay.
And he came up to New York when I was living there. He and I got a cup of coffee at the Empire State Building. I had an office there, and it's not as big as you think. And it was great seeing him. Dave Ruth is a very good friend of mine. Doug Westerman who's at KSDP and also at The Fan is a very good friend of mine as well. I speak to him all the time. Ventura again is just, Ventura was so great in so many ways. I loved working with Ventura. I loved working with, Vogel. I loved working with Suchere and Royce. That was just a fun group of people to work with. Vogel was great. I loved working with Vogel. I used to take him to buy Christmas gifts.
If you have, if anyone has tapes of Don Vogel, those are collector's items, because Don Vogel was, only here for, I think, less than 5 years in two different stints, but the audio, and if you don't know who Don Vogel is, he was a blind man.
I have some of it, and I really should throw it up on YouTube.
I think we should talk, Peter. We should talk about getting some of those things digitized. I think there's some great material there that I think that that this audience would appreciate, and we can talk about that. We do have to go, though. I appreciate you coming on the air, though, Peter.
No problem. I appreciate it. Thank you for your time.
Let's do it again sometime, shall we?
Will do.
Thank you, Peter. Peter Thiel, a former producer, Barbara Carlson's producer, and also a minor personality at KSDP. Before we go, I do want to mention a couple things. Tomorrow is the Paddock Museum's Minnesota Broadcasting Hall of Fame inductees. It'll be at 7 tomorrow night. It is sold out. But some of the inductees, which we've talked about before, that'll be Mark Rosen, Dick Bremer, Mick Alsamo, Jack Thayer, Barry Zavan, Kim Jeffries, Bob Johnson, Eleanor Mondale will be inducted tomorrow. So a great event at 7. If you have a ticket, this is great. If not, come next year. It's a fantastic event benefiting the Paddock Museum of Broadcasting. We'll be back next week. We have Bob DeFlorest. He is a mutual friend of Stan Turner's and myself. He'll be on next Saturday talking about film collecting. This is Flashback Twin Cities on KLBB Club 1220. We'll be back next week.